Welcome to the debate. Have you ever been to an emergency room where the administrative paperwork felt way more important to the staff than the fact that people were visibly suffering in the waiting chairs?
Oh, absolutely. It's the worst feeling.
Right? So imagine walking in, right? You're bleeding, the lights are glaring, machines are whirring, and the doctors and nurses are just working frantically, but they aren't actually looking at you.
Yeah, they're looking at their screens.
Exactly. Their entire focus, like all that immense energy, is totally consumed with maximizing patient throughput or, optimizing billing codes and basically ensuring the hospital's financial survival for the next fiscal quarter.
Right.
The patients are, well, they're no longer the purpose of the institution. They are just the raw material required to keep the system running, you know?
It's a totally frustrating, frankly, dystopian image, really. You're sitting there in pain, and the machine of the hospital seems completely detached from the very reason it was actually built.
Yes, exactly.
It exists to serve itself, not to heal.
Exactly. And the reason we are starting with that image today is because it perfectly captures the core diagnosis of a really fascinating 2026 white paper by Dr. Bishara Saheli. It's called From Ungrieved Trauma to Globalized Insecurity.
It's a heavy read for sure.
It is, yeah. But it asks this massive question, right? What if that exact dynamic, where the institution forgets its purpose and just works to feed itself, is the fundamental reality of the modern nation state and its, massive security apparatus?
Right, the whole defense sector.
Exactly. And I'm taking the position today that when I read this paper, I see a really precise diagnosis of our global condition. It essentially argues that our institutions have become self-preserving, sacrificial machines. They actively convert human trauma into perpetual conflict because they need that conflict to survive. And that's why I think the paper's proposed life-coherent solutions are absolutely essential.
Well, it is an elegantly argued paper, I'll give it that. And I agree with some of its moral foundations. But my position today is that it fundamentally misreads the tragic reality of what it actually takes to keep a society safe.
How so?
Well, characterizing a state's security apparatus primarily as a pathological or, life-blind system, it might sound profound, but it severely risks ignoring the legitimate, often ugly necessity of state defense. I mean, secrecy and force aren't usually institutional malfunctions, right? They are the required tools for dealing with very real, immediate threats in an unforgiving world.
Right, I get that. But let's look at the mechanics of what the paper actually calls institutional autopoiesis, because that's really the engine driving this whole dynamic.
Okay, break that down for us.
So, autopoiesis is originally a biological term, right? It describes how a living cell constantly recreates itself to maintain its own boundary in existence. But Dr. Saheli applies this to human bureaucracies.
Right.
When an intelligence agency or a military apparatus undergoes autopoiesis, it stops asking, how do we protect human life? And starts asking, how do we secure our budget, our operational authority, and our relevance for next year?
But that's.
And so the institution actually becomes the organism it is trying to protect. And the human population, well, we become expendable fuel. We become soldiers, units, demographic variables, or, acceptable waste.
I come at it from a different way because you're describing the defense state as a parasite, and that completely ignores why the host allowed it to grow in the first place, you know?
A parasite is a strong word, but yeah, it's feeding off the population.
But a state's monopoly on legitimate force isn't a pathology. It is a necessary shield. The text poetically dismisses this as a sacrament of the state. But let's be grounded here. That monopoly on violence is the only reliable bulwark against the exact atrocities the paper itself lists.
You mean the massacres and terror campaigns?
Exactly. Massacres, hostage taking, terror campaigns. When a state mobilizes its citizens, it is rarely because a blindly humming administrative machine is just, hungry for budget. It is doing so to prevent its society from being eradicated by actors who absolutely do not play by the rules of mutual survival.
I hear you. But are they truly protecting the society, or are they protecting their own relevance by basically managing the society's fear?
Managing fear?
Yeah, because to answer that, the paper asks us to look at the raw material these institutions use to build their power. And that material is collective grief. The thesis here is that the global war system literally runs on ungrieved insecurity.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. You're saying these institutions are just manufacturing this fear? That is an incredibly cynical view of human conflict.
It's not about manufacturing it from nothing, though.
But people in conflict zones are genuinely terrified of being wiped out, right? They aren't waiting for a defense ministry to tell them to be afraid. The fear of annihilation isn't some narrative construct. It is born from centuries of persecution, from recurring wars, from real missiles flying into real neighborhoods.
Right, right. And the initial wound is entirely real. The paper doesn't deny that at all.
Okay.
I mean, it uses the Middle East as its primary case study, and it explicitly acknowledges the profoundly agonizing historical traumas on both sides, right? The Holocaust on one side, the Nakba on the other.
Exactly. Deep, deep historical wounds.
Yes. So the question is not whether the pain is real. The question is the mechanism of what state institutions do with that trauma. If the fear is purely organic, like you say, why do state media, military spokespeople, and educational systems work so systematically to artificially narrow the circle of empathy?
Well, they narrow it because in a state of existential threat, a society has to maintain a hardened psychological perimeter just to survive.
But at what cost?
You cannot constantly grieve your enemy while they are actively trying to destroy you. It's just not psychologically or operationally feasible.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. Look at how that perimeter is built through what the text calls cultural violence. It happens through language, right?
Like rhetoric, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. When an institution constantly uses terms like demographic threat or collateral damage, or, you know, refers to children as embedded infrastructure, they are actively working to dissolve the concrete, breathing human person into a strategic, sanitized category.
I mean, military terminology is inherently detached, yes.
Right, because they are taking ungrieved historical trauma and converting it into political fuel. It creates a system where some people are made conceptually killable long before a weapon is ever even fired.
That's a dark way to look at it.
The paper proposes a diagnostic test for this, which I think is brilliant. Can a society grieve the child of the other without feeling it is betraying its own? If it can't, that is clear evidence that institutional narratives have intentionally walled off that trauma to basically sustain the war system.
Okay, look, I will grant you that the dehumanization of language is a poison. But that equal grievability test assumes a perfect world, doesn't it?
I don't know if I'd say perfect, just human.
But in a war zone, moving from the psychological to the operational is incredibly messy. And the manipulation of narratives you're pointing to naturally brings us to the paper's major critique of secrecy, right? You're essentially arguing that institutions hide their manipulation from the public.
Exactly. Because the only way an institution can sustain that kind of cultural violence is if the public is kept completely in the dark about how their security is actually being managed. Secrecy is the mechanism that separates the suffering on the ground from the public's understanding of what is being done in their name.
And here is where I must strongly defend the traditional state model, honestly, because secrecy is a fundamental operational reality of statecraft. It just is.
But does it have to be?
Yes. The paper calls for something it terms accountable intelligibility, the idea that state power must be totally understandable to the people it affects. But if we demand real-time transparency for intelligence sources, military plans, and covert operations, we actively disable the state from protecting the very lives you want to save.
I'm not saying publish battle plans on the internet, though.
But if an intelligence agency has to publicly explain its methods for tracking a terror network, well, the terror network learns the methods, adapts, and the public gets bombed. You simply cannot broadcast your defense mechanisms to the people trying to kill you.
Okay, but the paper doesn't deny that limited tactical secrecy might sometimes be necessary in a specific, time-bound operation.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, what it critiques is the secrecy shield. This is when secrecy stops protecting the public from the enemy and starts protecting the institution from the public.
Okay, give me an example.
Look at the historical mechanisms the author documents. Take the 1953 covert overthrow of Iranian Prime Minister Mossadegh by Western intelligence, or the massive domestic surveillance abuses exposed by the Church Committee in the 1970s.
Right, the COINTELPRO stuff.
Exactly. Those secrets weren't kept to stop an imminent bombing. They were kept to overthrow democratic governments, maintain imperial influence, and completely avoid democratic accountability.
Sure, those are well-documented historical instances of overreach, and I don't defend them, but they don't invalidate the structural need for classified operations today. We operate in an anarchic international system, right? Not a global town hall.
But those examples prove a fatal design flaw in the system. Think about how a healthy human nervous system works, right?
Okay, I'm following.
If you accidentally put your hand on a hot stove, the nerves instantly send a screaming signal to your brain, this is causing damage, pull away, right? The feedback loop ensures your survival.
Sure.
But the secrecy shield does to a state is administer a localized anesthetic. The state's hand is in the fire, it is launching drone strikes, destabilizing regions, creating massive blowback. But the secrecy completely blocks the feedback from the victims back to the decision makers.
The decision makers know what they're doing, though.
But the policy author is severed from the harmed body. How can a security apparatus claim to be learning or protecting life if it systematically severs its own ability to feel the consequences of its actions?
The nervous system analogy is clever, I'll give you that. But a state is not a single biological body. It has to prioritize competing threats. I acknowledge that hidden power causes harm when unchecked. Of course it does.
Right.
But direct violence, bombs falling, troops crossing borders, hostage taking, is usually what demands an immediate, forceful response. That's the fire burning the hand. The state's primary duty is to stop the visible, acute destruction of its people.
I completely agree, but...
We can debate the oversight of intelligence agencies all day, but when a kinetic threat is at the border, the state's focus has to be on neutralizing it.
But what you're calling a kinetic threat is almost always just the final visible symptom of a much deeper, slower form of destruction. We have to look at structural violence. If we only focus on the bombs, we are completely ignoring the massive, normalized architecture that guarantees those bombs will eventually fall.
Ah, structural violence. That is a term that gets thrown around a lot in these discussions. How are we defining it here?
We are defining it mechanically. Let's look at the economic data the paper actually cites. It points to a 2025 UNCTAD statistic showing that developing countries are paying $921 billion in net interest on public debt.
Wow. Yeah, that's a massive number.
It is. Now, let's trace the mechanism of how that debt translates into actual violence. When a country is bleeding nearly $1 trillion, that isn't just a spreadsheet problem. That translates physically to the ground.
In terms of infrastructure, you mean?
Exactly. It means a municipal water filtration system isn't built, so cholera spreads. It means premature babies die because the hospital's power grid fails and the incubators shut off. It means severe austerity measures and crippling sanctions.
Right.
The mechanism of debt and economic blockade physically destroys bodies just as effectively as an airstrike. It is simply a bomb dropped in slow motion over 10 years.
Look, I don't dispute the tragedy of severe poverty or, you know, the inequities of global finance. But framing national debt or economic sanctions as violence on par with a military invasion, it broadens the definition of violence so much that it becomes operationally useless.
Why useless?
Because if you are a security professional tasked with stopping a terrorist attack, telling you to go solve global debt restructuring is a category error. A state's defense apparatus is built for acute threats.
But it's operationally essential if we ever want to actually stop the cycle of perpetual war. If a sanction regime predictably damages the water supply and medical access of a civilian population, it is an act of violence.
But it's policy.
Policy that kills. This is why Dr. Saheli's paper advocates for mandatory correctives. It introduces the minimum harm test and the mutual survivability test.
Okay, explain how those would actually work in practice.
Right, so the idea is that before any state institution acts, whether that's passing a sanction, launching an operation, or sending an economic policy, it must prove two things. First, through the minimum harm test, it must prove it has exhausted all non-destructive alternatives.
Okay, standard proportionality kind of stuff.
Sort of, but stricter.
and second, through the mutual survivability test, it must demonstrate that its strategy for security does not require the permanent domination, impoverishment, or dispossession of another population.
That sounds...
Security has to mean mutual flourishing, what the paper calls a life knowledge commons, rather than just, you know, survival of the fittest.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered the sheer impracticality of that in the real world?
Impractical how?
In a nation trying to unilaterally apply a life coherence criterion, when dealing with a heavily armed proxy militia whose stated theological goal is your total eradication.
Well, obviously.
How do you apply mutual survivability to an actor who totally rejects your right to exist? To attempt that is essentially unilateral disarmament. The state cannot pretend it lives in a post-structural utopia where everyone suddenly agrees to prioritize mutual flourishing.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, because is the current system actually realistic, though? Let's look at the mechanism of your pragmatic traditional security. You perceive a threat, you use overwhelming force to neutralize it.
Which works.
Short term, but that force inevitably causes massive civilian harm and infrastructural collapse. That trauma generates profound grievance, which mathematically guarantees the recruitment of the next generation of insurgents, which then requires you to expand your security apparatus even further.
It's a tragic cycle, yes.
Right, so if your realism mathematically builds the infrastructure for tomorrow's enemies, isn't traditional security doctrine actually the most dangerously utopian strategy of all? The illusion is that you can bomb a population into submission, manage them as a demographic threat, and achieve lasting security? That is the true fantasy.
Well, true security cannot exist as long as interlocking institutions use structural violence to convert human populations into disposable assets. The cycle of violence you're describing is tragic, and I agree it is real. But the alternative isn't simply dismantling the state's capacity to defend itself.
The paper isn't calling for dismantling defense, just reforming it.
Reforming the state via intelligibility is a noble goal, I'll admit. But demanding absolute transparency and mutual survivability in the face of acute, immediate threats risks fatal vulnerability. We cannot treat the tragic realities of geopolitical survival as mere institutional malfunctions that can be fixed with a new ethical framework.
It's clear we remain fundamentally divided on whether the nation-state can genuinely be reformed out of this autopoetic loop, or if the transparency and mutual survivability the paper demands inevitably conflict with the harsh realities of defense.
Yeah, it's a deep divide.
But I think it is important to highlight where our perspectives genuinely converge today.
Well, I completely agree with the paper on the profound danger of cultural violence. The way language is used by institutions to dehumanize, to turn breathing human beings into mere demographic threats or acceptable waste, is a poison to any society.
Absolutely.
It lays the groundwork for atrocities. I stand entirely with the moral necessity that every child is equally grievable. If we lose that capacity for empathy, we lose our humanity, regardless of what security doctrines we follow.
That convergence is deeply important. It shows the value of looking past the daily headlines of kinetic violence to really examine the deeper, submerged architecture of globalized insecurity that Dr. Sahaly outlines.
Right.
Because when we understand the mechanisms, how debt functions as violence, how secrecy severs the feedback loop, how language makes people killable, we see how our institutions actually shape our realities and define whose lives matter.
It is a demanding piece of source material, and it forces us to confront very uncomfortable realities about how power sustains itself.
It absolutely does. And so we leave you, the listener, with a question to turn over in your own mind. When you look at the architecture of the modern world, are we trapped in that hospital waiting room, serving an administrative machine that requires our sacrifice just to keep its own lights on?
Or is a transition to a world where security means mutual survivability not only a necessary evolution, but really our only real hope? Thank you for joining us.